Welcome back to the Winter War Podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 13, and it's an unlucky number for the Finns. Wednesday the 13th of March 1940, to be specific. They had held off the might of the Soviet army for more than 3 months, but on that day, they finally signed the ceasefire treaty and were forced to surrender a large patch of their territory. So before we get there, let's wrap up the Winter War. Red Army Commander Timoshenko decided to deploy 40% of the Russian army in the next major assault, which began on the 11th of February, as you heard last episode. When they failed to achieve all their goals, the Russians reorganized once more. They reinforced and returned on the 28th of February. The meat grinding had pushed the Finns back from the Mannerheim line. The Russians burst through at both Popius and Million Dollar Bunkers, forcing the Finns to retreat to the intermediate line. On the 26th of February, as the intermediate line began to bend and buckle, the Finnish army launched its one and only armoured attack on the Russians at Hunkaniemi station. 15 Vickers tanks from the 4th Tank Company rolled out, armed with the rather puny 37mm guns. Their mission was to support the infantry and try and regain lost sections of the interim line near Vipuri. Only 8 tanks actually made it to the staging area. 7 had stopped because there was water in their fuel lines. Then 2 others broke down with engine trouble. That left 6, but another promptly got stuck in a ditch. The Russians, though, were shocked. The infantry scattered, never having been attacked by Finnish tanks. The 5 remaining tanks engaged 20 Soviet T-28s, and despite the fact that they were armed with much more powerful 76mm guns, the Vickers took out 8 of these, but then lost 4 of their 5. The remaining tank withdrew. The Finnish tank battalion never managed to recover from this incident before the end of the Winter War. The Finnish 1st and 2nd Army Corps had been given permission to retreat from the intermediate to the still incomplete rear line, the 3rd line of defence, on the 27th of February 1940. This line ran from the south of Vipuri to Lake Vuoksi, where it intersected with 3rd Army's front line, then continued to Taipali on the eastern edge of the Karelian Isthmus. Timoshenko had a nasty surprise for the Finns. He had ordered the next major offensive to begin on the 28th, and when the Russians attacked early the next morning, they overran the entire sector's interim line that had been constructed behind the Mannerheim line. It was now that the Finns began taking heavy casualties, because the Mannerheim line had collapsed. The Finnish 2nd Army Corps recorded 5,000 casualties, for example. And yet, the Finnish High Command was still determined to hold on to the strategic isthmus town of Vipuri, which was the anchor point for their last effective line of defence. There were 2 reasons for their hardline attitude. Firstly, if the Russians broke through this town, they would have a clear run all the way west to Helsinki. And secondly, negotiations were on the cards, and Helsinki wanted to retain as much territory as possible before what looked like a surrender. As the red tide approached, not all was lost. Finnish Foreign Minister Vaino Tanna had attempted to reopen talks with Moscow by every means he could think of since the first days of the war back in December 1939. Secret emissaries had been sent to the Baltic states, personal direct appeals issued to the British and the French and the Swedes, but so far there had been a chilly silence from Moscow. But as I explained last episode, Stalin was growing more and more paranoid about what the Allies were planning to do in his all-important oil-producing Caucasus. On the last day of January 1940, Russian Foreign Minister Molotov formally recognized the Finnish government led by the Raitytana coalition. Stalin was in a hurry to end the Winter War so that he could refocus his forces in the south, in the Caucasus. The British and the French, as you heard in episode 12, were running intelligence rings around the Russians, tapping Stalin's paranoia, holding clandestine meetings with the Turks. Moscow has a real fear of the Turkish ability to upend its control of its southern reaches. Prior to this moment, the Russians had been spinning a narrative about there being a communist government that was the real political force in Finland. The Kusini regime was always a puppet for the Soviets, and now Moscow made a sudden move to recognize Helsinki's democratic government instead. By doing so, the Russians had opened the door to direct negotiations. Anyway, the world had ridiculed Moscow's Kusinin government without mercy. It is also true from scrutinizing records of that time that Stalin was never fully enthusiastic about the Kusinin charade in the first place. And Stalin's quick and dirty sideshow in Finland had turned into a global embarrassment for the Kremlin, a military debacle that had shown the fault lines inside the Red Army. Hitler, who was obsessed with destroying the Slav nation, took notice of the Russians' weakness. Here was obvious proof to anyone watching that Russia had decimated its officer corps during the bloody purges of the late 1930s and was paying for this in the ramshackle attempt at overrunning a tiny neighbor. A larger army, say the crack German organization, would likely pulverize these badly led Soviet troops. The Caucasus were in some danger. It wasn't just Anglo-French provocateurism. An Anglo-French intervention was really worrying the Kremlin. It had been a remote possibility when the Red Army invaded Finland, but now it was almost a certainty. Two major schemes were being plotted. One involved the French rearming the Poles in exile and then transporting them to Potsamo, the Finnish northern port, where they turned south and come to the aid of the beleaguered Finnish army. The second was a major airstrike, which had been first used as a red herring, but was now turning into a concrete plan. The idea of Allied planes taking off from Turkey and bombing the Caucasus oil plants reached Finnish commander Mannerheim's ears. Churchill and his advisers were considering a major policy change they dubbed the Big Plan, which was the brainchild of General Sir Edmund Ironsides. It called for the Allies to openly declare their intention of sending military aid to Finland and demanding that Sweden and Norway give them the right of passage through their territories. Both of these countries were bending over backward, trying to avoid both the Germans and the Russians, so were unlikely to allow the Allies easy access. The British planners were already considering breaking League of Nations rules and landing there anyway. As we all know, if you're in a strategic position, your neutrality is threatened by a likely military invasion when there's an existential fight going on. Belgium and Holland were proof of this. Many other states were going to be forced to decide in the coming years of war in Europe. The French increased pressure on the Brits for boots on the ground, but it was important for Finland to make a formal appeal for help. At this point, the Germans and the Russians had invaded Poland and cut up the country and shared it amongst themselves, and the Allies weren't automatically at war with the USSR yet. If the Allies sent troops to help the Finns, it could be regarded as a declaration of war by Moscow. The main reason why the Allies were so bloody-minded about Finland wasn't that they cared about the Finns. No, they were more interested in securing the important iron ore in northern Sweden and the fields in Finland itself. Things were not progressing well for the defenders by the end of February 1940 and the beginning of March. In the last week of February, they'd pulled out of their coastal battery positions along the Straits of Koivisto, and shortly afterward, the Russians roared towards the Finnish 4th Division based along the intermediate line of defence at Pulanimi. General Ockwist once again requested permission to withdraw, but Mannerheim refused. And what Ockwist didn't know was that negotiations were imminent and the old general was determined to protect as much Finnish territory as possible before any white flag would be raised. There were scenes of utter devastation being played out, and one incident in particular needs retelling. Timoshenko had ordered another massive attack on the 28th, as I said, and near Kronstadt, the artillery barrage was particularly brutal. However, the barrage landed 1 mile short and eviscerated an entire Russian unit. The artillery bombardment included the 12-inch railroad pieces, which were firing from over the border, along with 16-inch Russian shore batteries. All of this heavy shelling landed on a group of Russian soldiers assembling for the infantry attack due to take place after the bombardment. Inside this 2-acre killing ground, there were more than 400 Russians scattered by the force of the blasts. Even the Russian artillery spotter had been hit by this friendly fire. He was found still clutching his receiver in a sitting position, a map on his knees. Was he trying to get an urgent message back to his guns? They were hitting their own men? The Finns seemed to think so. The Finns were desperate for peace talks. By late February, the Soviet demands were spelled out in detail. The cession of Hanko Island as a Russian base for 30 years, the cession of the entire Karelian Isthmus back approximately to the frontier of Peter the Great, and the signing of a mutual assistance pact between Helsinki and Moscow. The Finns hesitated. Meanwhile, the Allies continued to offer support to Helsinki. However, the government didn't know what to do in the face of a likely defeat. The Allied offer, which they didn't trust, and the loss of territory to the Russians. It was a mood of paralysis, just as their people needed proactive diplomacy. Foreign Minister Vaino Tana went to Stockholm on the 27th of February, just before the Russians' next major push. He was trying to convince Sweden to drop their neutrality position and to allow Allied troops across their territory. The Allies were dependent on getting their troops on board the electric railway to secure the iron mines of Narvik. All the Norwegians had to do was pull the power plug, and the Allied invasion would have sputtered to a halt. The Swedes told Tanner he'd have to sue for peace on whatever terms the Russians preferred. They weren't going to get involved. The Soviets, meanwhile, set a deadline to accept their terms for March the 1st, 1940. Mannerheim passed along an update on the military situation to the political leadership and was now openly pessimistic. On the 29th, the day after this awful bombardment that butchered so many, the Finns sent a message to the Russians that they accepted the terms of surrender in principle. When the Allies heard about the offer, they were incredulous. The French in particular responded rather clumsily. Prime Minister Edouard Daladier sent what is now called an infamous telegram promising 50,000 troops to Finland by the end of March and 100 bombers that were lining up ready to fly to Finland. The British contemplated sending their own force immediately. Back in Helsinki, the Finnish leadership gathered on March the 1st to consider the recent diplomatic messaging, and because they were seeking anything positive, they tended to believe Daladier's crazy promise. As they hoped and prayed, a significant event was playing out on March the 4th, which was to have a major effect on Finnish military doctrine. The Soviets had seized a hill near the strategic town of Vuosalmi, and the task to retake the hill was given to a unit of men conscripted from a village called Nurmo. These men of the 8th Light Detachment from the 8th Division marched into position to assault in the darkness, but arrived too late, and their commanders decided to launch a daytime assault. It was mid-morning when these courageous men from Nurmo charged across open snow and Soviet machine gunners cut them down. In a few minutes, the village of Nurmo lost nearly all of its adult male population. 40 dead, 30 others badly wounded. Only 19 made it back to Nurmo after the war. And after this fiasco, the Finns changed their overall call-up doctrine for raising units and separated men from the same villages and homes into different brigades. The British had learned this rule in the First World War, where the so-called PALS battalions were made up of villages and where entire villages lost their young men on the Western Front, sometimes in one day. The French and the British continued to discuss how to help the Finns, but by March 5th, it was clear Paris could not send any troops immediately. It would take them 3 months at minimum to mobilize the men, while the British could only mobilize by mid-April. There would be no immediate international help. They had wasted 5 days. More Finns had died, and there really was no hope of anyone coming to their aid. For the Soviets, they were now making good ground. Their Red Army steamroller was in full motion, so they waited another day or two before replying to the Finns' call for negotiations to secure more territory. The worst danger spot was on the western edge of the Isthmus on the Gulf of Vipuri. There were 8,000 Swedes, along with over 700 Norwegians, fighting here. These international brigades members were tasked with defending the rear line, the last defensive position, as 5 Finnish battalions and a handful of artillery pieces moved forward on the Gulf coast. Mannerheim ordered General Kurt Wallenius to take charge. That was the man who'd stopped the Russians during the early Arctic battles, if you remember. This was a bridge too far for the old man. When he arrived at the Isthmus, with its shrieking artillery bombardments and screaming wounded, after he'd lorded it over the frozen north with its Arctic expanses, he turned to the bottle. Such was the shock. On March 3rd, Mannerheim relieved the drunken general of his post to be replaced by General Usch, the chief of the general staff. That night, the Soviet 28th Corps managed to secure 2 bridgeheads on the western coast of Vilanimi and Haranpanimi. The Russian 10th Corps burst through east of Tevojoki, seizing the small inlets near Vipuri. A Finnish counterattack pushed them back. The Russians lost 15 tanks. It was also on the 3rd that the Finnish Air Force made their last proper raid, pilots collapsing after flying numerous sorties at treetop level. At Sursari and near the Saimai Canal, they took out columns of Red Army troops and were watched by the coastal batteries. At least half the Russian column at Sursari ended up as casualties in these raids. Then on March 5th, the Russians threw an entire division at Vilenniemi Peninsula, supported by 100 tanks. The Finnish shore batteries at Ristiniemi broke up the ice the Russians were using as roads, and entire companies of men drowned on that day. The equivalent of 30 Russian divisions were hammering away at the Finns at the Gulf of Viipuri and ploughing into the rear line, along with 1,200 tanks and more than 2,000 aircraft, adding to the unequal fight. Eventually, Vilenniemi was lost. No counterattack could save the town. Then the island of Uras, close to Viipuri, fell. Entire Russian battalions were being wiped out, but they were just being replaced by unending reinforcements. By March 6th, the Finns had selected their negotiators, who included Juho Paasikivi, Risto Raiti, and General Carl Walden, as well as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Vaino Voinma. These men flew to Moscow via Stockholm, along with their support staff, and arrived on March 7th. The only bargaining chip they held was the window for peace, open until March 12th. These men knew that the Allies' promises had been broken. Finland was on its own. Post ipso facto, most military experts agree, had the Allies gone through with their boots-on-the-ground big plan, the landings would most likely have been a disaster on the order of Dunkirk or Crete. The second big shock for the Finns was that the Russians were not going to be flexible at all. When negotiators asked for leniency, Molotov responded frigidly. He accused the Finns of being a tool for Western interests. Sound familiar? It should. It's the same playbook being used by Vladimir Putin in the 21st century. Some things never change. The third big shock for the Finns was that the Russians had changed the terms of surrender. Things were far worse than they had been led to believe. In addition to seizing Hanko and pushing back the Karelian Isthmus border, Finland would have to cede the entire Rabachi Peninsula in the far north, as well as a portion of land in the Salla district. The Finns would be forced to build a railway line connecting Murmansk with the port of Tornio on the Swedish frontier. The delegates were stunned, to put it mildly. They said they couldn't agree without further consultations. On March 9th, the Helsinki leadership had a heated meeting about these terms. Meanwhile, the Red Army tsunami was pulverizing the Finnish battalions all the way along the isthmus. Most of the Finns' large guns had fired so many shells they didn't even have rifling left in their barrels by now. On the Karelian isthmus, the Finnish 23rd Division fell apart, and for the first time, an entire battalion cut and ran. No Finn had ever run from battle like this. It was obvious the troops had passed their breaking point. And by the 8th, shells began falling on the town of Viipuri for the first time in the Winter War. The end was in sight, both diplomatically and militarily. Not a moment to lose. So the political leaders sent a telegram back to the Finnish delegation in Moscow that read, "Headquarters has furnished situation report. Not sanguine about chances of carrying on as continuation of war on the basis of aid promised is difficult. We authorize you to decide the matter in all respects, provided you are unanimous." Negotiations began in Moscow on March 10th, actually before this telegram arrived. Paasikivi told Molotov that even Peter the Great had paid a large monetary compensation for his Finnish border back in 1721, to which Molotov snapped, "Then write a letter to Peter the Great. If he orders it, then we pay compensation." The Finns pointed out that the Russians wanted territory they hadn't yet conquered. Molotov pointed out that the Finns could always come back later once the Russians had conquered it. The Finns withdrew and began drafting the text of a peace treaty that incorporated all Russian demands. In London and Paris, the Allies were on the verge of panic, particularly the English, where low-level hysteria was reported in the halls of power. The Brits needed to secure the northern waters around Sweden and Finland to protect vital iron ore. On the battlefield, new orders were issued by Finnish HQ on March 9th and again on the 10th. Soldiers were now to evacuate all islands around Viipuri, and many of the defenders retreated into the ancient citadel near the harbour. Even modern heavy weapons barely chipped this incredibly well-designed fortress, which was hewn from granite. The imposing citadel was built by the Swedes in 1293 and had survived numerous battles against the Russians, who seized it from the Swedes in 1710, but it passed back into Finnish hands in 1812. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain joined French Prime Minister Daladier in a statement in Parliament that their governments stood ready to help the Finns. After months of dilly-dallying, the phony war was in full swing. General Ironsides, in a confidential note at the time, said the British and French politicians were a flock of bewildered sheep faced by a problem they have consistently refused to consider. I came away disgusted with them all. It's no surprise that shortly after this political flip-flopping debacle, Chamberlain was cast aside in favour of Winston Churchill. On March 12th, the Finnish government made their decision, although two ministers balked at the severity of the Russian terms and resigned. President Kallio signed the document giving the Moscow delegation the authority to end the war on Moscow's terms. Then he growled, "May the hand wither that is forced to sign such a document as this." A few months later, Kallio suffered a massive stroke that left him paralyzed in his right arm. The treaty was signed by all parties in Moscow on Wednesday, March 13, 1940, and a ceasefire went into effect at noon on the same day, Leningrad time. In a final act of revenge, the Russian commanders bombarded the entire front with everything they had at 11:45 in a vicious gesture that killed and wounded hundreds more Finns. Then the guns fell silent. The Winter War was over. The Finns had begun the war with approximately 150,000 men. About half were listed as casualties by the end. After the armistice, the Karelian Isthmus defenders marched westward toward Helsinki, proud of their achievements over the past 105 days. Almost the entire civilian population marched with them, dragging their possessions on sleds or carts, abandoning the land their ancestors had won in battle against the Russians. They were forced to yield Viipuri, nicknamed the Paris of the North. Across Finland, people wept at the news of defeat. They had no idea they'd be back at war with the Russians in 15 months when Hitler's Operation Barbarossa kicked off in June 1941. The Finns in particular sought revenge for what Stalin had done to them for these 105 days. So, our next episode 14 will be the last covering this Winter War. We'll take stock and also focus on what this means in terms of modern world military history. There are ominous overtones of a similar situation developing across the Baltic states in 2024, driven by Russian nationalist aims and the new Tsar, Vladimir Putin, who published a kind of Mein Kampf doctrine in 2014. Like Hitler, he has been very clear about his stated aims in Europe, which include Ukraine, Moldova to the south, and of course Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. The Finns know probably better than anyone else how dangerous this Russian emperor is, given their history, and why this time they've gone straight to NATO and signed up. As I produce this podcast, Russian troops have moved to the Finnish border in an eerie echo of 1939. This time, the Finns have full NATO support and don't have to worry about the limp-wristed Neville Chamberlain. Please head off to the website desmondlatham.blog for more details about this and my other shows. Until next, and for speakers of Finnish, an apology for the coming bad language. Vrta pakin.